Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 4th, 2004. Today's speaker is David Bella. The session number for today is BED 2004-04. The lesson for today is Understanding Complex Human Behaviors Beyond Blame, Faith, Competence, and Evil. Let's listen in.
They call biological weapons the poor man's nukes. At least 11 nations and several terrorist groups already possess the knowledge. Many more seek it. And
That's just about the ending part, and I want to make sure we have some time, a little bit of time, to debrief on that. If you want to see the rest of it, there's just a few more minutes. First off, can we get some lights and maybe someone turn off that? I may want to put that video on because there's a scene.
You want to put the video back on
somewhere? Yeah, so why don't you put the cap on? And it is important to debrief on this because there's a lot in here, a lot that they haven't really talked about. Okay? So, first thing is I just want your feelings. One or two words, no explanations, just feelings. What you saw.
Why would anyone release something like smallpox when that can be carried everywhere? I mean, kill their own people, themselves.
Okay. Other reactions. I'll come back. Okay. Reactions. I want your reactions.
Fear, scary.
Dreadful. Scary. Huh?
Yeah, just very scary.
Scary.
Yeah.
Dreadful.
Man's desire to disobey God and play his role.
Okay. We'll have to get into that one.
Yeah.
Okay. What others? Reactions?
They're lying.
Huh?
Lying.
Lying.
Anger.
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 Other else?
Other else? Physically sick.
Sickness. So I got all these words up here. Horror, sickness, anger, lying. Horror again. Anguish. Anxiety. Okay? Now, I want to just take one brief moment. Did we see anything else in there? Is there a message in there?
Well, we also saw a couple of people who were defected because they couldn't do it.
Well, we also saw our government, saying we're squeaky clean.
Let's get back. First of all, in the defections.
I mean, I see that as a slight sign of hope that there are consciences. Okay.
They haven't really, this front line has sort of avoided some things.
Okay.
Okay. They will say the generals did this. Yeah. Turns out it was really more the scientists. Mm-hmm. And the scientists would be complaining that the generals were too slow on this. And the first guy that defected, remember they saw him in the shopping market? They didn't really ask why he defected. Alabek, in his book, describes a discussion with him right before he defected. And do you know what his concern was?
I can guess. They're not going fast enough. He's looking for someone else to do.
Alabek's concern?
No, the guy who was defected and shares some things with. His concern was they had a mandatory retirement age at age 55, and he was 51, and he was facing a midlife crisis that he hadn't done his best work yet.
And he figured the United States was going to do more.
No, he was just in a midlife crisis. When you're in a midlife crisis, you don't figure too much. His identity had been so much taken over by the work. Now, there is another scene there, though, that I want you, I'll see if I can get it back on. This video is a little bit hard. But it's one I really want you to look at. And it's really going to be I want to get your reactions. It may take me a little while to get it here because they don't have the numbers down. Well, they don't even have a regular number system here to allow you to go back.
Let me just see. Is it on there?
And we are talking about genetic weapons.
No. Gotta go back a little bit more. I may not be able to find it. I don't know why they're...
What year is this?
This year, this was done before 9/11. President Clinton was president at the time this was made.
It broke down every
they've got a whole new numbering system that they had last night. I don't know how these machines does it, but I may have to skip it. We do need a machine that you can at least back up on.
Davis produced a flashlight, which was a...
All right, it's the scene. I'll describe the scene. We'll turn it off, I guess. And I'll describe the scene. Okay? One scene I want you to try to recall.
Push the button twice.
And it's the scene of Alabek, chief scientist. Somehow they seem to avoid them. And he's getting ready, and he walks up to the Lincoln Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he says something.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Remember what he said?
I'm not a believer, but I think God will forgive me.
He has this phrase, and it's, to me, it's so powerful when I see it. And it goes something like this. I am not a believer, and yet in my view there is a God. And he will forgive me. Now, I want you to imagine Alabek at last night's Vesper service. And Alabek sits down, kneels down, in front of the circular. Remember the circular or bowl that holds the candles? And what is it, the sign when people kneel before the circular one? What does that mean?
To pray with.
That someone can come up and touch them and pray with them. If Alabek was that person, and you saw that, what would you do? What do you feel?
I'd pray with him. I feel pity for him.
Pity?
Suspicious. Well, he was caught up.
Let's explain. He's there. He said that.
Okay.
You're not. You have nothing to explain. You're there to be present. Mm-hmm. And the question is, would you put your hand on his shoulder? That's it. That's it. What does our tradition say?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. And more than that, it seems like, is what would be going through you as you put your hand on his shoulder. In the session we had last night, there was one line that struck me. For those welcoming, those in need of forgiveness and grace. When you put your hand on his shoulder, would you be a vehicle for God's grace? Mm-hmm. And so, to me, there's something profound here. Because all of those bad words that we have, which are real, in spite of all of them, there is grace. God's grace. Okay, we got to feel it. Because Alabek and us would not be denying any of that. All those horrible things. and in the act of touching, putting our hand, we become a vehicle to God's grace. In spite of all our own hang-ups.
Probably one of the main differences between him and other people is the matter of opportunity and situation. He was there, he had an opportunity for a nice job, and that was his job. There would probably be somebody, including myself, who has certain sins, and sins come in packages. You know, they say that somebody's a liar is probably also a thief, you know, maybe. But sort of come in groupings, and just if somebody's evil, they're evil, and that kind of makes all of us. So I would, I probably would not feel uncomfortable at all. Just like the movie, The Judgment of Nuremberg, that's how it ends. You know, it could be us sitting in that chair.
Okay, well, we've got to pursue this. Gotta pursue this a little bit more. But I want you to first get in touch with the feeling. Because we are coming in the Vesper, we are celebrating a tradition, a faith tradition. And the putting on of the hand says something. And I'm going to tell you a story, and I've never told it to any other group, and I may not be able to, I may choke up. It's about a dream. And I was railing against somebody who had done something. I was so angry, and they had really done it. All of a sudden, I saw this woman. And that woman was God. And she looked up at me with this beautiful face, sad eyes, and said, "He's my child too." And I can hardly say that without tears. God mourns for that. And what I want to now do is tell you that I think we can draw upon our faith traditions to try to get a better grip on evil. And in some strange way, Alabek, particularly when he says that, I was just moved, can help us. Alabek has written a book since this about his experience. And it is an honest book. And one of the things that I'm doing as part of a study is, and there is a report that I have, and you can get copies upstairs, okay, it's a research project, is to try to understand the notion of evil and faith, but first evil, by drawing upon Alabek's book. And there's a few things that they didn't tell you in this. One of them, of course, was the guy who did retire, or who did defect, that he was worried about leaving his job. Now, did you notice a few other things in this movie? Big things that we should. When the United States inspectors went to the Soviet Union, what was the nature of the reaction of the Soviet scientists?
Arrogance.
They were kind of proud of what they had done. Now, another thing that they didn't tell you is one of the reasons the United States didn't pick this up is because the scientists in the United States were nuclear scientists. And scientists are notoriously narrow in their understandings. And when Alabek got here and he got interrogated, he could hardly believe how little they knew. He says, "Find me someone that knows something." And they got the one guy, Patrick. And he was amazed how little they knew. But there were a few other things in this movie. David Kelly, do you remember seeing David Kelly? Okay, United Kingdom. Anybody heard of what happens to David Kelly?
Oh, yeah.
Before the Iraq War, BBC comes out with a report critical of British government for sexing up the intelligence to justify war. Okay? David Kelly turns out to be the source of that information. David Kelly was the person who was saying, wait a minute, on Iraq, you're sexing up the information. You're making it sound, more severe to justify the war. There's a big turmoil. And in the aftermath, David Kelly took his life. And then again, you see Grace, whatever reasons he went through, it's such a tragedy. And it turns out that the BBC reporters got fired. And there's a whole other story I could tell you on that. Now, what I'm proposing to you is that when we study, when I study Albeck's work, when I do it, it tells a lot about me and how I read that book. Okay? And I have two choices when I read that book. And what I have done is I said, there's two prayers that I can say as I read the book, whether I actually say it or just act it out. And the first prayer is, thank God I'm not like him. Okay? Have you heard that prayer before? Jesus even told us about that prayer. That's right. The Pharisee who went to the temple to pray. He was the believer, the true believer. There was someone else in the temple, and who was that?
Poor person.
The publican.
The bad guy,
the publican. And then when Ken Albeck says, well, I'm not a believer, but in my view there is a God, and he will forgive me for all I've done. He's the publican. So the second prayer that I can use when reading his book, reading his study, the second prayer is, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Okay? Now, as I do that, okay, who's the us? Is it us in the room? Who would be the us as I'm reading that book?
Everyone.
Including Albeck?
Yeah.
Especially Albeck, and especially me. You see, Albeck was in research. Albeck worked for a highly effective program. I've done that on occasion. And so when I read that, it makes me look for things that are different than the things that I would say, thank God I'm not like him. And what I found was not really said very well in this video. If we ask people, well, why would Albeck do it? Oh, to save the motherland. He wasn't even Russian. He was Kazakhstan. Oh, because he was a dedicated communist. He'd just roll his eyes and say, you gotta be kidding me. Okay? Well then, he was forced to do it. Well, no, this wasn't under Stalin. Well, to make money, that's sort of what they imply here. Well, yeah, a little bit, but not really. So why? Why?
Because the job was there and he wanted to.
And why would he want to?
There's a push in all of science to you know, just push the horizon, push the horizon, push the horizon, and almost become God by trying to, you know, kind of proving the vast expanse of what humanity can do, and I think that's very much what's going on here.
And you can say something that he was young, I mean, like he rose very quickly, and he became, I mean, who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want to be continually moving up
and
be a success?
Okay, success and competence as a scientist. Now, when he was young, his education was a doctor. And he had this idealistic view. And when they first entered the program, they used to stay up. How can we do this? And as he got more involved in the work itself, the question, how can we do this? He said the same thing, but it became different. Different meaning, you see? You get the tone? The first one, how can we do this? It's a moral question. The second one was, how can we do this? It became a technical question. And what happened is, his identity, this is what I'm finding, his identity gets so taken up by his work and showing his competence that his vision of what the consequences are shrinks to the point that the questions didn't even come up. Remember the guy that stuck his finger and died? They described him as a very jovial person. He loved social gathering almost as much as he loved his work. Now, what happens is, when I say this, this makes some scientists and engineers and managers who are very competent people rather uncomfortable. And you can understand why. Because I'm afraid that in our society, we've taken the expert up and we put them up on this pedestal, and yet we have the case here without the experts. That program would have mattered nothing. And in fact, when they say the generals were running it, that's really not a very accurate picture. Because the scientists would complain about these backward generals that were, you know, that weren't supporting their work.
Weren't the scientists also in the military?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. But they identified themselves as scientists.
Not as scientists.
And they also talked about being civilians.
Yeah, and they had civilians. They're about 60,000 people.
He said he resigned his commission and so on.
Right. He was appointed a commission, but he was a scientist. On his wall, he had pictures of great scientists. They identified them as being great scientists. And when they came back to the United States and they start talking with scientists here who knew the subject, they began to get excited about the work. Now, it goes further than this. Because there's another scientist, a young man, who was working on the genetic engineering. Okay? Was working on genetic engineering. And he defects after the Soviet Union collapses. And he too says, we did terrible things. And now there's one line that I thought was important in this other book, not in Alabek's book, interviewing him, and the author didn't pick up on it. He says, you know, what I've done is terrible, but I have to confess that I have a hard time stopping my mind from figuring out new ways of doing it. Now, does this sound like an addiction? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now.
Or a passion.
Right? But I mean, when the passion becomes demonic, when it captures you. Okay. Now, in fact, the word passion has both positive and negative tones. Let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. Recent research in science indicated that revenge, actually, the thought of revenge actually triggers a pleasure sense in your brain. And they say that the passions, okay, can lead to great harm. And of course, this is an old example of St. Augustine. And so what I would say is, using scientific language, the scientists themselves, in their commitment to work, okay, that can become an addiction. And I mean an addiction in very much the same way a drug addiction, where it's hard to stop it, even when you know it's destructive. Now, when you begin to look at this, you begin to see how competence, being competent, has what I would call a demonic side. Now, let me explain the word demonic as I understand it from Paul Tillich. The demonic is always associated with the good. Always associated with the good. A thing becomes demonic when a vehicle to goodness, a means to do something good, becomes overextended and it becomes the substitute for the good itself. So, competence. Well, look how much good you can do with competence. You can heal diseases. You can solve pollution problems. You can prevent hunger, cure the sick, people say, by being competent. And it's all true. But when competence becomes an end in itself, when it becomes the good in itself, then we would call that competence becomes demonic. Do you get the idea on that? Yes.
I hear you going on about the scientific personnel and not saying anything much about the colonels and the generals, who are at least officially in charge of the program, and while they may not have the technical expertise to direct the details, they certainly had the authority to stop it.
Well, let me.
And they also can have the same narrow focus on killing,
now,
which is where they directed the researchers to put their energies.
And I'm not denying the role of generals out there.
And
although,
true for military in general.
Although it turns out Callanan, who was the general who was in charge, was really a manager. The old line generals usually bungled the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason they formed BioPrepare, is because they wanted to get it out of the control of the generals who really were too stuck in old ways. But let me explain a couple of reasons why my emphasis has not been on the generals. I'm not a general. It would be very hard for me to say, lead us not into temptation. If we had some generals here who have been in command positions, or maybe some CEOs, okay, they would be in a better position to do that, drawing upon their own experience. What my experience does tell me, though, is the people at the top know a lot less than we give them credit for. Okay? And in general, we don't want to believe that, because we'd rather blame them at the top. In general, the people who are sometimes most trapped in the system are the ones with the most power in the system. And most of the time when I have gone and I say, those guys blame, and then I've met the people, I've been upset because I haven't found the villains. That's a hard way to explain. We have a model in this world to understand how bad things happen. Is bad things happen from bad people. That's our model. Okay? That's called a linear assumption. That the whole, this whole big program, the character of it, can be reduced down to the character of the parts, the people involved. Okay? That's the way we think. That's called analysis. In a linear world, that would make sense. Now, I'm using terms now, linear and nonlinear, that really come from mathematics, but I'm not going to get into mathematics. All I want to say is, in our civilization, for the last several hundred years, the way we explain things is we break them down into parts. So, we get something bad wrong, what's the part that broke? What's the part that's wrong? Now, if the world really were linear, okay, I could be a great musician. Why? I can play great notes. Okay? I could play great notes. You listen, man, that sounds like a pretty good note. That's, and I get on the piano and say, now I'll play a lot of notes, and that'll make great music. It won't. You say, that's terrible. The whole is not equal to the sum of the parts. Now, this may sound like an esoteric deviation, but it isn't. It's fundamental. And I think we will not understand evil, truly evil, if we insist on taking the whole and breaking it down to its parts. Now I realize that that sounds a little far out. The research that I'm doing now is how the whole can create a system where ordinary people like us find good reasons for behaving in some ways and not others. And the outcome is evil. Okay? How that's the theoretic, that's the stuff. And it is controversial. It is controversial. I'll say that.
Well, one of the things that I've seen is the European background is the one that's always been linear. We in our native community have always done the circle. And everything, we individually are a circle, and everything in our circle can be both good or evil. And it ended up as a community, we are a circle. And it ended up these linear thoughts that came, has come from the European background.
Well, I'll make a little departure from here. The linear came from about the time of Newton. Okay? This is where, I mean, if you would take St. Francis of Assisi, or if you would take the Celtic Christians who were, they would probably come closer to the thinking of native people than they would to modern, say, science or analytical people. There was a revolution that happened, and it draws us in, all of us in, oh, a couple hundred years ago. As we wear watches, as we read, we begin to think in different ways. So there is a historical time period, and I think we can learn to think in other ways through the traditions of native peoples and also through some of our older traditions that predate the modern era. Now, I'm not saying throw out the modern era. You know, most of us want indoor plumbing and things like that. And you know, engineers, I'm an engineer, we build stuff with that. But I do think that we can learn from our own traditions and other people's traditions to think in new ways that are more circular, like you say, rather than linear. In doing so, however, I think I have found, I can only say, that the prayer, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, is essential. Because when I don't repeat that, I find myself slipping into the other prayer, thank God I'm not like them, blaming people. And I find that as soon, in fact, I've been trying to study, apply these approaches to the intelligence leading up to the Iraq War. And it is a very difficult thing to do, mainly because it's very lonely, because people choose up sides intellectually right before they even start. As soon as you choose up sides, and if I'm saying, well, wait a minute, let's see if we can see this. I don't, like one guy, he insists that Colin Powell lied. Okay? I say, well, I don't know whether he lied. And then they get upset at you. You say, well, let's see what happened. Anyhow, apart from that, let's get back to this. What I'm suggesting to you is that there are some real opportunities to understand evil in new ways. And evil cannot be reduced down to evil people. There are evil people. I'm not denying that. But what I'm saying is you can't reduce all evil down that way. And if we do, then it's almost like the devil is out there just laughing at us. You know, the symbol of evil. Like saying, oh boy, this is really great. They're simplifying it into this nice way that points the direction of everybody else. And everybody's pointing a finger at everybody else. And I get to do whatever I want.
Screw tape letters.
Huh?
Screw tape letters.
Yeah. Everybody's,
I think one of the things that most impresses me about this film, though, is the presence in all of this of a moment of grace.
Right.
Because of Alabek's defection and repentance and all of that kind of thing, you know, and the way that he's done that. I mean, I look at, I think the issue is certainly much broader than just biological weapons. I mean, I watch where a lot of medical research goes in this country right now,
correct.
And that's because that happens to be my field. I look a lot at that, and, you know, there is a lot of the science itself, the knowledge, being the God that we pursue.
Right.
And in fact, you'll find very few scientists who will talk about God.
Right.
And so I guess what my question is, or just kind of just the issue that keeps coming up for me is, how do we create the opportunity for grace to step in this situation? Because I think there, I mean, I caught myself doing this, just getting more and more narrowly focused and forgetting the big picture of what are we doing in the scheme of things, and how are we keeping God in God's proper place and all of that kind of thing. And as an individual person, that prayer, I think, would be a really useful thing to think about. But I wonder more globally, like, now that we've got a culture right now where certain research is pushing, where, how can that opportunity for grace to enter be created? How can people facilitate that? What do we do differently about that?
Mm-hmm. Boy, really good questions and good insight. Very good. The question is going to be far better than my answer. Okay, so, but I'll try a few things, okay? Just a few things. One of the things we have to realize, and Betty, they sang a song where simple things are holy. That was the last line. And as I've done this, I've realized that grace happens in a lot of different ways that we quite often don't notice, and they are important. When I talk to the scientists or researchers or engineers about some of these problems, there are three reasons why they tend to avoid them. One, I'm too busy. Sort of been holding steam this week and with that. Second one, it's not my job. Third one, I don't see how anything I could do make a bit of difference. Now, what I think faith does, surely understood, faith does not deny those three things. Yeah, you are too busy. Yeah, it's not your job. Yeah, you can't see how to make a difference. Do something. Anyhow. Okay, and you notice the smile when I said that? I'll tell you a story, okay, because your smile reminded me of it. I was teaching a course, and we were covering environmental problems, and the students were getting so depressed. Oh, they were just getting depressed. I said, what am I doing here? I'm depressing everybody. So what I would try to do is try to convince them, okay, yeah, here's some solutions. And they shot me down. Every solution was either too small to make a difference or too big to pull off. And what am I doing? So I finally just sat down in the chair. When a teacher does that, you yield to authority. And then I said, well, is there something you can do? And they said, yeah, there's some way to roll. I said, stop, just don't say anything. Just say, there's something you can do. Maybe just write a letter to. Say a prayer. I mean, something. I said, so they said that. So now tell yourself, say to yourself, but it will make a bit of difference. Now tell yourself, I might get in trouble. Now tell yourself, I might even be wrong. Now tell yourself, but I'm going to do it anyway. And they smiled. And I said, the real question is, do you want to live with that smile? And I think those smiles are gifts of grace. That's the closest, you know, or one way you can talk about it. So we have to realize that in our faith tradition, we do things that are absurd, not because we're irrational. I think that's where science is missed it. There's reason and faith and faith. But we do things in spite of the fact that within the system, we have all these reasons not to do them. And that's because God transcends the system. That's because God is beyond whatever the system is. Does that make sense? So what I would say is do something. Do something. Yeah.
Isn't that how Holden became Sir Everett? Was one lady wrote a letter.
And the man.
So my thinking was, well, would that one letter make a difference? But I guess it does.
But the trick is, we have to do these things even when we don't see any way it can possibly make a difference.
Paul Simon was here last summer, and he said, every time you write a letter to a congressperson or a senator, you are probably saving someone's life. We think letter writing is so, you know, they're inundated with these things. And he said, honestly, from his perspective he said, every letter makes a difference, every single one. So.
And you remember the story of Jesus, the widow's mite. She gave what she had. And so the fact that we don't have a whole lot compared to the problems, that's not the point. That's not the point. Okay.
We do what we can do.
You do what you can do, and sometimes it surprises you what happens. But a lot of times you do what you can do, and you'll never see the outcome. Mm-hmm. And we just accept that. Now, I do think that for myself, one of the barriers for that quite often comes from simply blaming others, and then the bitterness, and that demobilizes. So I think it may be better to recognize that all of us get caught up in these patterns of behaviors, other people too, and God calls us out of the bondage of those patterns of behaviors. And they may be patterns of addiction, they may be patterns of work, they may be patterns of pettiness, or feeling bitter, or being cynical. I can get into that one. We talked about that. It's easy to get into that. And we can get into those patterns, and those are forms of bondage. And God calls us out of bondage. And it's a real call. And if God can call and accept, and we look at Alabek when he said that, and we said, will God forgive him? And people nod, almost sometimes even reluctantly, because it would be so much easier to hate them. And yet, if God can do that for Alabek, isn't that for anybody?
Isn't there a theological problem there? Why would God forgive somebody who doesn't believe in him? Or would you be doing asking for forgiveness by there's a God that can't forgive me?
I think the real key is we should not make the Lutheran a belief of work. Remember, it says gift of grace, not by work. And I think sometimes we make believing a work. I think the real key is God believes in us. And what we need to do is act it out. And remember the parable Jesus told. Remember? Two sons, and one said, oh yes, I'll do this. He said all the right words and didn't do it. And the other one went out and said all the wrong words. No, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to. Totally, everything he said. But in the end, he acted. according to his Father's will. Okay? And Jesus says, who really did the Father's will? No one who acted. And he says, go and do likewise. So, for Alabic, what he believes about, whether his beliefs correspond to mine on theology, I'm not going to judge that, because too easily I can become, and I see others, becoming the Christian Pharisee. By, I believe this, I believe this, I belong to this church, I do this. Thank God I'm not like that person out there. Okay? God is a loving, caring God, a gracious God. And that, I think, is fundamental to us. We have a lot of beliefs, and if we look at the history of even the Lutheran Church, those beliefs change over time, but God stays there. And the grace of God stays there. And for me, just personally, I would welcome Ken Albeck, and if he knelt down there, I'd put my hand on him. And I would feel God's grace, and what he believes and what I believe. You gotta realize the word belief, you know, the word belief, that really originally meant in English, beloved, what you give your heart to, not what you give your head to or your mouth to, what you give your heart to.
Well, him kneeling would be an act of faith. Mm-hmm.
But didn't you see the way he talked?
Yeah.
I mean, that was, to me, that was kneeling. That was really...
That was confession.
That was confession. I mean, it's profound. I mean, it moved me.
It struck me about the fact that he said, I'm not a believer. And it just struck me as being said, I believe in God. I almost feel like, well, what is the definition of believer? And who has defined that? And is that his definition, or is it the definition of different churches who say, well, we're believers, and we're a particular group, and you have to do this, and this, and this, and this,
right,
and this to believe.
Yeah.
And he doesn't feel like he fits there.
That's right. I think you hit it right.
But he believes, and he believes that God will.
But he says, in my view.
And we've been the ones that have given him the impression that he's different,
right,
and he's not
correct.
Welcome, and that...
I think you're right. I think he's sort of saying that, you know, I'm not part of one of these church communities that has a whole lot of beliefs. But in my view, there is a God. And he will forgive me.
Which is all that's required.
Huh?
Which is all that's required.
Yeah. Yeah.
A couple of times you made reference to demonic and devil. And I think statistics show that most Christians do not really believe that there is a devil, that it's more of an abstraction. And I disagree with that. I think that when we fail to recognize his existence and we give him elbow room in our life, that he can capitalize on the evil that's in us and expound it. And my daughters came back from Cambodia, and you know, it's not a sophisticated society, and there's no discussion. Everybody assumes, you know, that the evil thing, you know, that the demonic world is very real. And here in the Western world, we're sophisticated. We don't believe in it. And so we like to philosophize about evil. And I mean, if you even only half believe the Bible, you've got to believe in you know,
well, demons. I think we are at the point of literalism, which we can, that's another topic. I think, if someone believes in it symbolically, I'm not so sure that that's believing in it any less than believing in it literally. But let me make one point. I'm reading on the meaning of words, and this is just something that may get you thinking. And this guy claimed that our word believe meant beloved, giving your heart to. And he quotes this sermon, which we would translate, believe in God but not in the devil, from the Middle Ages, or it's back quite a ways. And he says, this would sound paradoxical. But if you take it's the word because, you would have some people say, I believe in God and I believe in the devil. And the person back then would have thought you were schizophrenic, because how could you give your heart to God and give your heart to the devil? You see, the word believe meant not in my mind thinking about it, it meant giving your heart to it.
I was referring to the 20th century definition of belief.
I know, and what he's saying is the notion, this is what Wilford Cantwell Smith, the notion that faith equals belief, he calls a modern heresy. That it is in the last couple hundred years that we have made faith equal to belief, particularly belief in spite of evidence to the contrary, stubborn belief. Faith is more than that. That's what he's claiming. Faith is more. And he said that has to be one of the most important things for us to uncover, a real meaning of faith in our modern era that doesn't drop back down to dogmatic belief. Just belief in. And in fact, the work that I'm doing, really, to be honest with you on this, is I'm really trying to explore the meaning of faith in a world of all of this.
It's a mystery.
Yeah. But it's real. Yeah.
Another question.
Yeah.
The prayer, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. It seems to me it's part of a bigger prayer to God, and the part that's perplexing to me is that we would pray to God that God not lead us into temptation.
And I don't know what the history of the translations of that really are. I think it comes from all that occurs, God is involved in all that occurs, so we don't want to be. And temptations do arise in the world of God. So I've tried, in a lot of these prayers, I try not to use them for me to define what God is, but rather what my relationship is in the world. And somehow, lead us not into temptation, if I think of it that way, how many times I've been led into temptation. It takes on a reality. But if I try to use that, all right, what's the nature of God? Is he out there leading me? If I try to make it about God, which is far more than I can, then that one becomes a little tougher. So generally what I've done is I've tried to say, all right, those are the words. What does it mean to get led into temptation? Well, for me, you know, I can get so hooked into my research, I can get so hooked into my work, and so much, I've been led into temptation. For possibly good things, maybe even God. We could say God leads us there. But it can become demonic. That's the way I have it. Now, I think the way they say, do not put us to the test. That's isn't that one way that they take that phrase? I think in the whole of, I don't find that as powerful as lead us not into temptation. Yeah?
Our faith tradition has a lot to say about evil. And we've got a prophetic tradition, a mystical tradition, to give us some kind of rope to hang on to lift us out of whatever systems
right.
we've gotten ourselves into.
And that's a good way to put it. They lift us out of those. We need those systems, but we need more than that. And what they do is they help us see beyond or feel, sense God, beyond whatever system we're caught up with it.
Yes, whether it comes from, you know, the church at the forefront where it could be and has been at times saying, giving prophecy and saying, this is wrong and God's going to punish you unless you get out of the system. We also could use something for people who are not in our tradition or who don't have some kind of faith tradition who might even say that, well, wait a minute, there is not a divine. So this system is the reality of the sum total of what it is. I mean, I'd like to hand them a rope too.
Oh yes, I think so. Because if we don't, the danger to us is we become Christian Pharisees. Thank God we're not like them.
But if I can't sell them the divine, or if I can't sell them the God in which I believe, I mean, I recognize that, you know, I can hand this to other faith traditions and say, how to appeal for the relationship with the divine. But if I can, you know, how could I hand this to an agnostic and say, how could I give this person to help lift them above the system?
That's a very good question, and I think part of it, though, is as we struggle with that, we learn a lot also, not just them. We learn a lot. And that's sort of what I'm trying in this paper, is to bring the notion of faith to make it real, and so I can publish it actually in a professional journal. Okay? Now, I've done it, okay? And that means I can't go ahead and give them church doctrine. I have to deal with a reality and then say, look what happens when we don't sense a responsibility that transcends, goes beyond, whatever system we're in. Horrible things happen. Okay? So what I've done is I've introduced transcendence and responsibility, and to a large extent, that's what faith is about. Okay? To a large extent. Now, what I do have, I will be leaving a couple of papers here that take some of the research that I've done. And I have one manuscript of the research project, Faith, Competence, and Evil. It'll be upstairs. And I have a couple of other papers, including one in the journal called Emergence. And it's largely about human organizations. And in that, we do, in the end, we introduced the notion of faith into that. And it got by the peer reviews. So I think that's, you know, one way that we can try doing that. And in the process, I learned a lot from doing it. Okay, yes?
Just a comment as far as, people that, quote, are non-religious or whatever else. I think there's a lot out there, though, that even if people don't have a specific faith journey or religion or something like that, that there is a lot of sense of sort of faith in the universe or faith in the powers of life and the good of all people and that kind of thing. And I think that there is more universality than, for example, those that are just in the Christian tradition or the Jewish or Muslim tradition or whatever else. I think there's a lot more universality than we sometimes acknowledge in people having a sense of something beyond themselves, the universe, whatever else they look at it as. And I think that commonality can be really drawn upon as well.
Yeah, even in science, the notion of truth that they'll have is sort of a partial description of God. Because if you're a scientist and you say, we have the truth, well, nobody else needs to pursue it. Truth you're supposed to pursue, you're not really a scientist. If you're a scientist who says, oh, there is no such thing as truth, you're not really a scientist either. So truth is an aspect of God, in one sense, that is always transcendent, and we're supposed to respond to it.
And I think we're front, I mean, people who have been raised in North American culture, I think there is a strong undercurrent of the history of being a Christian society, whether or not they were raised Christian or had that. I think there's a lot of, even if they don't have any desire to have a religious or understand the divine or believe in the divine, I think they believe that love is a pretty universal and important thing, and that's a value. And I think there's a lot of values, and I think what you said about truth is really important. And I think there are some people that address it, like C.S. Lewis. I forget what that book is called, but he wrote a book for his friends that were non-Christians, and it's all about spirituality. So I think that there's ways to have a conversation without necessarily putting Jesus Christ, and you have to believe in Jesus Christ, and these are the values, and well, the value can be love, because God is love. We just don't have to put a stamp of Jesus on it to have a conversation.
And a lot of people in the world have their exposure to churches has been made.
Yeah, definitely.
So they have this view of Christian faith that is so hostile that, and I say, well, I wouldn't belong to that either. And so they'll have that, and I mean that's a real problem. Yeah, Barry.
I kind of feel like in my career as a fishery biologist, I was surrounded by a lot of people who did not profess a faith in God, but who lived out Christian behavior better than a lot of Christians.
Okay.
Treat your neighbor as yourself. Treat the earth as sacred, basically, something that you can't recreate. And it needs to be protected for future generations because they're your neighbor as well.
And it's surprising how many of them, like Gordy Reeves, for example, he was, I think, raised Lutheran. Okay? And they've sort of reached a point where they got really burned and they don't want to be part of that. But it's amazing how much of the good theology they've integrated into their lives. Now, of course, what happens to the next generation? These are concerns that we have. What happens when people don't know the story of the Good Samaritan? Okay, what happens when they just don't even have a clue about that story? That's going to be really hard. Yeah. But I've met people that way too.
Who were you talking about? I'm sorry, this gentleman that you're talking about.
Who? What?
You just mentioned.
Oh, Gordy Reeves.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. He's a fisheries biologist who's been very active. Very active and a wonderful person. And I don't know whether I don't think he belongs to any church now. I've talked with him and we talked somewhat, and he says, well, that makes sense to me, but I think that there are a lot of people. I'll just use an example. Marcus Borg, for example, who's written some of the books that are in the bookstore in there about the historical Jesus and meeting Jesus again for the first time. He wrote that book, and he was raised in a very dogmatic way, and he just couldn't keep that faith. And so then he comes back, and he writes this book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. Like the first time, he really didn't get Jesus. He got a whole lot of baggage. So I think Marcus Borg's books, they're over there, they're very good.
Yeah, reading the Bible again for the first time.
Is he
a newer one.
That's his newer one? Okay. I haven't read that. Have you read that one?
Yeah.
Okay. He's a very good, very wonderful person. His wife's an Episcopal priest, too. And so he's... if you get a chance to read one, they're in the bookstore, right? I find a great deal. People who, I'll be honest, people who are more into a literal interpretation find Marcus's books uncomfortable. But they, when they meet him and they talk, it's amazing how much they have to share. Okay, that's the bell. And I want to thank you. There will be a number for, particularly on staff, or people who are here for a while, there will be a number of papers that I have up there. And I have to go, and I'll be leaving the village today, so I have to go haul my baggage down. But I really appreciate talking with you, and thank you a great deal.
Thank you. Thank you.